Hi there, I'm Sam Hawley, host of ABC News Daily. Our podcast covers one big news story each weekday in just 15 minutes. From history-changing world news to cost of living concerns at home, expert guests and ABC journalists explain what matters most. We cover breaking news and the big challenges of our time. Follow the ABC News Daily podcast on ABC Listen.
From Wondery Country, I'm Luke Sidham Dundon, and today on The Breakfast Wrap.
Currently, I'm on panic mode because people are dying. I don't have medicines, I don't have vaccine to support countries. Western countries, they don't understand that when Africa is affected, they are also at risk.
That is the head of Africa's Diseases Prevention Center, Dr. Jean Kosiya, raising the alarm as a growing Ebola outbreak infects and kills people in the DRC and Uganda. Today you're going to hear from someone who was a key figure in Australia's coronavirus response. They're now in Geneva watching the global response to this outbreak.
They're pretty concerned. It looks like this outbreak has been underway for probably two, maybe even a little bit more months. And the trouble with something like Ebola is once it gets away from you, it is really difficult to bring back under control.
Former Health Department Secretary Professor Jane Holton is coming up. Then, just how different are the Coalition and One Nation on immigration policy? A senior opposition frontbencher defends his party's approach. From the Radio National Breakfast team, this is The Breakfast Wrap. With so much happening all over the world, I wouldn't have expected that we would be leading with this story on Ebola this week. But over the weekend, things have progressed pretty rapidly. The World Health Organization has declared an Ebola outbreak in the Democratic Republic of Congo as a public health emergency of international concern. It's a declaration the WHO has used in recent years for Mpox, before that Zika and Ebola, and also for coronavirus. But it says that this outbreak doesn't meet the criteria of a pandemic emergency. That is important to know. So far, about 80 people have died, and there are 246 suspected cases in eastern Congo, according to the WHO. There are also cases and deaths in Uganda, and some that authorities haven't been able to connect directly to cases in the DRC. Now, before we get to our expert, I just want to bring you a little bit of background from our host, Sally Sara. She's the ABC's former Africa correspondent. She worked there for years. She crisscrossed the continent and she told stories from all over the region, including the DRC and Uganda. She gave us a sense of how the region's geography and connectedness could be contributing to cases over the border.
Some of these areas in eastern Congo I remember going to in the early 2000s, so Bunia, where some of the cases have turned up, that's one of the fastest growing cities in Africa, as remote as it is. And if you jump on the map there, it's quite close to Lake Albert, which is this long, thin lake, and down the middle of that is the border with Uganda. So that's why a lot of this traffic, people are on these very difficult roads in eastern Congo going up to the top of the lake and then into Uganda. So that's why we're seeing cases often lob up in the north of Uganda and then spill over into South Sudan. So up in places like Gulu and Lira in northern Uganda, which were, you know, back in the day, the areas where the Lord's Resistance Army was operating. So, yeah, very remote, but very, very good roads from Gulu down to Kampala in Uganda. So the Uganda and officials will be watching that very carefully.
Sally Sara there with some of the background on this region that is facing an Ebola outbreak. Well, Professor Jane Holton might be a familiar name from the years of the coronavirus pandemic. She used to lead the Federal Health Department in Australia, and she was a frequent commentator throughout the pandemic. She now chairs the non-profit Coalition for Epidemic Preparedness, and she's currently at the World Health Assembly in Geneva. She phoned in this morning and told us just what people there are making of the outbreak.
They're pretty concerned. It looks like this outbreak has been underway for some period, probably two, maybe even a little bit more months. And the trouble with something like Ebola is once it gets away from you, it is really difficult to bring back under control. It's potentially in conflict zones, so people are very worried.
So we know that there's long been a significant UN presence in places like Bunia because of ongoing conflict. How much does it complicate response missions when security is not guaranteed?
It really does make life very difficult. If you think about something like this where isolation, managing infection, actually dealing with patients who are infected and also making sure that people are properly buried because there are going to be deaths, there already have been and there'll be more, those become increasingly important. And of course, if you've got a conflict, it's very hard to put those sorts of conditions in place.
And this particular strain that we're seeing at the moment is the Bundibugyo virus. How does that differ from the others and does that have extra complications?
It certainly does. So Ebola, I think people have heard of it. They probably don't know exactly what it is. But basically it's a nasty hemorrhagic fever and it can be caused by a number of different types of this particular virus in this group. Now, we do have vaccines, and that's really important for the most common of these. Sadly, this particular variant, we do not have an approved vaccine. And that, of course, means it's difficult to control in the first place because of infection control. But then if you don't have a vaccine, and that, of course, is what everyone is now scrambling to do, to try and see if we can develop something, but also that we can do something about treatments.
Why isn't there a vaccine for this particular strain? Is it less common?
It is much less common. There's only been a couple of outbreaks that people are aware of, and it's probably important to know that Ebola was really only first documented a matter of some years ago in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, and also the Zaire variety is the very common version, and that's the version that we have the vaccine for. So no, it hasn't been the focus. People are working on it, let's be clear, but it hasn't been finalised, that work.
And generally the average fatality rate for Ebola is about 50%, is that correct?
Well, it can be much higher depending on the healthcare access that you get. So we've had everything from somewhere between 25% and 90% mortality. Good healthcare can help, supportive care, fluids, keeping people isolated, but of course not every community in a conflict zone is going to have access to that kind of care.
Jane, you were talking briefly earlier about some of the demographics and the geographical challenges here. We know the roads in some of these areas are terrible. They're only accessed often by motorbike or boat, which means particularly on motorbikes, people are holding on to each other in close proximity to get around. But in places like Uganda, there are some very good roads from the north down to places like Kampala. It's almost as if this thing is running on two speeds.
Yeah, and of course, people sharing bodily fluids, that can be in all sorts of different contexts. That is the way that this thing spreads. So it's not something that comes through the air. We all remember that from COVID. But in these sorts of environments, you can share those kinds of bodily fluids. And there are certain practices, particularly around funerals, that make that much more likely. Now, when transport is easy, as we know, the world is highly mobile. And that's why we don't know where this has gone yet, particularly in Africa. And that's why people are very worried about it.
And with things like motorbikes and then small boats on Lake Albert and so on, there's no manifest for this kind of transport.
No.
You don't know where people have gone.
No. These borders are really, really fluid and people move across those borders all of the time. I've just been talking with an African health minister and they think that there is probably an outbreak, something very, very close to one of their borders. And as he just said to me, well, basically, we don't know who's been in that community. We don't know who's come back to our community. So they're very worried about that.
And in some of those border areas, people identify more strongly along ethnic and tribal lines than they do by nationality. So people are crisscrossing backwards and forwards.
Constantly, for school, for family reasons, for work, for trade, etc. I mean, these borders are not the sorts of things that you or I would be used to going across the border from here to New Zealand, for example. These are literally places that people just come and go as they need.
So the WHO has declared this as a public health emergency of international concern, not a pandemic. What does this current declaration mean?
Well, what it means is that resources can be mobilised and it says to everybody, this is really serious. And so the WHO is mobilised, all the relevant people. Again, I've just been talking with somebody about that. It also means that organisations across the globe are mobilising to see what they can do to help. And the thing I would say is different about this is the huge level of cooperation. Everyone's springing to action, trying not to duplicate each other, trying to be supportive, but trying to bring their own expertise to bear. But what this does is say very clearly to the world, we need your help. This is urgent. People have already lost their lives and this could get a lot worse.
And from Geneva, that was Professor Jane Holton, the chair of the Coalition for Epidemic Preparedness. Well, we're going to dip into the debate on immigration that is partially being fuelled by the rhetoric from One Nation and also the response from the Federal Coalition. Last week, the Coalition proposed slashing Australia's immigration intake to align with housing construction rates. It also said it would block any non-citizens from collecting welfare payments if it won government. But as this debate consumes parts of Canberra, agricultural producers are warning that Australia's food supply could be threatened by any sharp cuts to the overseas intake. Tim Ryan is the CEO of the Australian Meat Industry Council, and here's what Sally asked him first.
How important is the migrant workforce for your industry right now?
It's currently very important, has been for a number of years. We employ a large number of Australian workers, but about one third on average of the employment in our industry is made up from an overseas migrant labour program.
And where do those people come from mostly, Tim?
We bring in people from all around the world and that really reflects the skills available, but a large number from the Pacific through the PALM program, as well as skilled labour through many Southeast Asian countries, as well as North Asia.
And Tim, even bringing those workers in, are some parts of your industry still dealing with regular shortfalls?
Absolutely. And there's different, I suppose, dynamics in regions across Australia. A lot of the pressures that we face kind of depend on factors outside our control, such as the seasons and the weather, and that drives the supply chain, but also how exposed you are to, say, global forces, whether you're exported or domestic. But certainly there are gaps. But the other challenge that we face is just the system of managing and processing visas is particularly frustrating. For instance, some of our members have been waiting up for 12 months for a visa to be processed with no real visibility of why it's being held up. So if you're trying to plan a business and look forward and prepare for the future when you've got this increasing risky environment, it's extremely challenging when you're kind of stuck in the mud thanks to our visa programs.
What can the processing times be like for some of those visas, and how much of a cost is it for businesses having someone just staying on that to get these workers in?
Yeah, so firstly, any business will always look locally to find a person. You always want to support local jobs, and it's ultimately far cheaper. You're only going overseas as a matter of last resort. So it is more expensive and it's also more time consuming. So like I said, you could be waiting up for 12 months. Some of our members are reporting for a visa to be processed. Sometimes are quicker, but generally all processing times are well in excess of government set timeframes.
Why is it proving difficult to continually attract local workers? Is there a sense that migrant workers are taking on the jobs that locals don't want to do?
It's not, I suppose, migrant labour taking it away from domestic workers. It's really a gap in the domestic workforce to begin with. There's many challenges. There's a lot of competition from other industries. Many of our rural towns, which were the backbone of the workforce in many blocks of in rural abattoirs, those workforces have kind of drifted to more metro areas, particularly younger people. So there's broader long-term population challenges that we face, but also we saw major disruption through COVID. Since then, we've really seen a much higher dependence on these migrant labour programs.
Tim Ryan there, the CEO of the Australian Meat Industry Council. Well, Dave Sharma is the Shadow Assistant Minister for Citizenship and Multicultural Affairs. He joined Sally this morning and she went to one of the political aspects of this debate.
Dave Sharma, the government has accused opposition leader Angus Taylor of using, quote, a typical One Nation playbook to try to divide Australians. How different are the Coalition and One Nation immigration policies?
Well, look, they're quite different. I wouldn't pretend to be a student of One Nation's policy, Sally, but the policies we've put forward are what we believe are in the nation's interest, and that is to make sure that when we bring people to Australia, there's enough housing to accommodate them in a way that does not put pressure on the existing housing stock for people who are already here, to make sure that our immigration program is working in Australia's national interests.
Which categories are likely to be targeted for reductions in immigration? What's the coalition's thinking?
Look, we will be revealing details closer to the time, and I'm not responsible for this part of policy development myself, but I would say that we've made quite clear that we want it capped to the number of housing completions in the previous year, which would see a significant reduction on the amount. Now, we recognise that there's still an important role for skilled migration, and we recognise that some skills, particularly in the construction sector, are in short supply and are not well represented in our skilled migration stream at the moment.
So has that maths been done at the moment and not announced, or the coalition's yet to figure out which categories it will target for cuts?
That work is underway, but we're 2 years away from an election. These are the sorts of details that we will reveal closer to the election, which will depend partly on, what's happening in the housing market at the time, and what are the skills shortages or skills needs for the Australian economy at the time. Those are the sorts of parameters we'll need to take into account when we reveal the more detail of this policy.
So that will be closer to the election. So the coalition has announced this policy but hasn't crunched the numbers as yet. Would that be fair?
No, I don't think that's fair at all, Sally. But I think what we've said is, this is a budget reply speech where you expect important principles to be announced and important headline policy elements that for policy.
But you've also got to know those principles are workable.
Well, yes, they are workable. I mean, I would just point out that for many years in Australia, the net overseas migration figure was closer to 200,000 per year. And that's the sort of ballpark figures that we're talking about here, right? Now, that worked in Australia for a number of years. It was achievable. It was feasible. There's no reason that similar programs or similar size migration programs will not work in the future. But as I said, we will reveal the details of that closer to the time.
Why should permanent residents who pay tax be excluded from welfare programs?
Look, I would say two things. Firstly, we want permanent residents who are eligible, and many are, to become citizens, because we think there is a distinction and an important distinction of commitment and principle between citizens and non-citizens. And secondly, and bluntly, we need to find a way to control government spending on welfare. I mean, government spending on programs like the NDIS, but also other government programs, has been growing far too quickly. And we think restricting access to some programs on the basis of citizenship or citizenship status is an appropriate way to help control that government spending.
Even those permanent residents who are demonstrating a commitment to Australia and want to become citizens, that process can take some time, sometimes over several years. What's the coalition's view on how those people should meet their needs during that time? For example, if there are emergencies that they have to deal with within their family?
Well, look, firstly, this policy will be prospective. That is, people who are already here as non-citizens and who are accessing certain government programs will continue to be able to access those programs. The policy would only take effect from the 1st of July 2028. So the people who arrive after July 2028 who will not be citizens, firstly, they will be made well aware of what they're able to access and what they're not able to access. Secondly, they will continue to be eligible for programs like Medicare, public schools, public hospitals. And then the final thing I'd say is many of these people now have to wait a number of years before they can access government welfare payments, even though they're not citizens. All we're saying now is, well, that is going to change. You won't be able to access, for instance, farm household allowance after 4 years of being a resident. You will need to wait to become a citizen. I think we're being upfront about that with prospective new citizens and arrivals, and it will encourage people to take out citizenship sooner. I mean, in Australia, we have about 16 to 17% of our population are non-citizens. That is significantly higher than countries like Canada or the United Kingdom. We want more Australians who are living here to become citizens. I think that's good for our nation and ultimately good for our economy.
And that is Dave Sharma, the Shadow Assistant Minister for Citizenship and Multicultural Affairs. He was speaking with Sally Sara on Radio National Breakfast. So when was the last time you went to see live music? Maybe it was at the local pub or a big multi-day music festival. You've probably noticed the tickets getting more expensive, and all around us there seems to be gigs getting cancelled. The industry still seems to be on really shaky ground. Now, it is better than where it was previously. Vibrancy reforms, which included extended trading hours and dropping liquor license fees for live music venues, have already had an impact. There's been a fourfold increase of pubs and bars now hosting live music compared to 2023. So from today, a state inquiry in New South Wales will look at what more needs to be done. Adele Robinson works in this space. She's the managing director for the music event promoter Fuzzy Operations, and she also has an overview of the industry. She's the co-founder and chair of the Australian Festivals Association, this industry body representing promoters and suppliers. So before she appeared at today's inquiry, she gave Sally her impression of just where the industry is at right now.
Look, I think we're in a very, very different place to where we were the last time there was a parliamentary inquiry about music. There's been a lot of work that's been done to prioritise live music and let promoters, artists and the public know that New South Wales values live music. But, you know, nothing's ever finished. So today's about recognising what's been done, but what else needs to be done.
What's worked particularly well in the past 2 years, do you think?
There's lots of things. So there's been the establishment of Sound New South Wales. There's been the 24-hour economy commissioner and his office, which has been fantastic in pulling through lots of regulatory reforms. There's been all the vibrancy reforms, which you mentioned, including extending the trading hours and trying to cut red tape. There's been a lot of work done in the kind of back end, really kind of practical solutions to make watching live music, going and seeing live music and performing live music easier and more cost effective.
There can be a lot of challenges and competing views. What's it been like trying to recalibrate the balance here?
Yeah, I think it's true. And I think that there are a lot of things that need to be taken into consideration. Obviously, music can affect a lot of people in a lot of different ways. But I think that sitting in the industry post-COVID, it was noted that young people in particular, they need to be going out and connecting in an IRL experience. And that's something that needs to be prioritised from a mental health perspective for youth. And I think that all of these reforms have really gone a long way to help that.
We've seen a number of not so great headlines for festivals falling over in various parts of the country, things like insurance and other issues as well. Has there been much of a turnaround there, Adele?
Yeah, look, I think it's a slow road to recovery. I think that festivals are it's one space where the rising costs and it being an industry where the break-even profit has always been quite high, that really hasn't come down post-COVID. So there still needs to be a fair bit of work in that space. Having said that, there are a lot of festivals that have had like real amazing growth. So Laneway Festival, for example, has had its best 2 years the last 2 years. So it's like any industry, there's ups and downs, but there are a lot of things that can be done to, in particular, help establish younger promoters coming through and newer festivals getting established.
And that is Adele Robinson, the co-founder and chair of the Australian Festivals Association. She will be appearing at today's inquiry in New South Wales. She's also the managing director for music event promoter Fuzzy Operations. Well, thank you so much for listening to today's Breakfast Wrap episode, presented by Sally Sara and produced by the Radio National Breakfast team. Oscar Coleman helped produce the Breakfast Wrap today. Plenty of interviews for you to go and find on ABC Listen, including today's pretty remarkable Changing Australia interview with a bloke called Peter Davis. He founded the Blood Bikes of Australia group, and I just wanted to give you a quick snippet of what this group does.
The courier system for medical couriers in Australia is actually very, very good and quite sophisticated. Where the system falls down is those last resort things where a test needs to be done or perhaps someone has to underestimate the amount of blood required for an operation, these last resort things. And you can't pull a courier, a trained medical courier, out of the air, out of thin air. So we all love to ride. That's the common denominator. And then to be able to ride and help people out is like a huge bonus. We actually had to devise a collective noun for blood bikers because there wasn't one. The collective noun for a stationary set of blood bikers is a clot of blood bikers.
I actually thought you might say that.
And if we're moving, it's a hemoglobin of blood bikers.
Of course it is.
Peter Davis there. You can hear more of his story in today's Changing Australia interview. You can find it by searching for Radio National Breakfast on ABC Listen. Well, I'm Luke Sidham-Dundon. We'll be back in your ears tomorrow.